It's the Wired.co.uk podcast, episode 81, for Friday, the 22nd of June, 2012. On the show this week, we'll delve into the world of robot fingers and find out why the future of touching and feeling could quite literally be in the hands of the machines. Also, have you considered helping out the climate by reducing the amount of meat you're swallowing? And Microsoft has finally said enough of this rubbish to everyone making iPad competitors by announcing it's going to make its own alternative this year, running Windows 8. All that and more coming up. Ahoy there, Nate Langson here, editor of Wired.co.uk. Joining me, news editor Duncan of Gear.
Hello.
How are you doing?
I'm all right. How are you?
I'm fine. And also Liv, Olivia underscore Solon, our associate editor.
Hello.
It's so good to be back in the room with you
my
guys.
My friend Alan wanted to say hi. He wanted to say hi to all the podcast listeners, so he says hi.
Hi, great. Alan.
Thanks, Alan. I've been away and I'm back. There's nothing I like more than being in a nice, cozy room with you guys.
It's pretty cozy today, isn't it?
Together. It's
the soft furnishings seem to have multiplied more than usual.
They have. This is actually probably the shortest turnaround we're going to have for a show because we're recording this at about 2:30 on Friday. We normally record on a Thursday and put it out on a Friday. So you're in for a real treat, people. You're practically listening live. But enough of this. Let's get on with some news. Liv, ACTA. Quick recap, please. There's been some developments in this controversial bill.
Yes, ACTA is, of course, the anti-counterfeiting trade agreement that's been rather controversial. It was a little bit like the SOPA Act in the US, the Stop Online Piracy Act. And it was meant to prevent piracy, but it was kind of pushed through very quickly through the European Parliament behind closed doors, and people have picked out a whole load of flaws with it. But anyway, what's happened recently is that INTA, which is the International Trade Committee, has voted to reject ACTA by 19 votes to 12. This is quite an influential committee, INTA, and actually its vote is likely to quite heavily influence the final vote that the European Parliament is taking in July 2012.
Because it's a trade committee, right? And this is an international trade agreement
on
the face of it. Anyway.
There's a number of different committees that have to vote on it, and INTA is one of the kind of key committees when it comes to this particular act.
So can we declare it dead yet?
Not quite, but if the Parliament kind of takes INTA's advice, which is obviously to reject it, then ACTA will, of course, be dead. But there's still a vote coming on next month.
Well, the final vote, I think, is the one next month, isn't it? So we should know by July whether ACTA is as dead as a dead cod in the sea or whether it's
just dying like a parrot in a cage.
Yeah. Duncan, it's been the longest day of the year. It's going to get darker from now on.
Until Christmas, pretty much. It's a bit of a depressing thought, really, isn't it?
It is. And there's some news to this effect.
Yes. A few days ago, obviously, it was the longest day of the year. But for the 44 Brits living in research bases across Antarctica, it was actually the middle of their winter. They've been in absolute darkness for several months now. In fact, they basically just have 2 days in Antarctica, and each one lasts about 6 months. But the BBC World Service marked this midwinter milestone with a special half-hour broadcast dedicated to those staff who are not just scientists, but also technical and support staff, engineers, those sorts of things. We can listen to a little sample of the broadcast, can't we?
We sure can.
Hello, Antarctica. This is the British Antarctic Survey midwinter broadcast.
Happy midwinter, Rob. We are so proud of you. We hope you are making wonderful memories and friends to last a lifetime. Miss you. Love you. Keep safe. Mum.
That was quite sweet.
It's wholly charming. The UK actually has 4 bases in Antarctica. There are 2 in South Georgia on King Edward Point and on Bird Island, and 2 on the continent itself on Rothera and Halley. But the programme that was sent to them included all kinds of music, musical requests, punny tracks like Comfortably Numb, obviously by Pink Floyd, and Heaven Knows I'm Miserable Now by the Smiths, but interspersed with messages like you heard earlier from mums and dads and brothers and sisters and dogs. And at the end, it concluded with a group sing-along of Here Comes the Sun, which was kind of adorable
and slightly ironic in that it probably wasn't about to come.
Well, it's their midwinter, so it's gonna get
but they could have had something like In the Bleak Midwinter, or,
yeah, that's true.
Snow,
this would be really
snow
depressing,
patrol.
Really depressing.
But it's got this wonderful festive feel to it. It's really lovely. You can listen to the broadcast on the BBC's website, as well as listen to past broadcasts that go back to 2008. We've got a link in the story that we wrote about it. It's lovely.
Actually, this story connects quite nicely to our next one. Liv, let me ask you something. Have you ever wanted to touch something but been too cold to take your hands out of your pockets to do so?
Yeah, I have actually.
Well, then I have news for you. Because roboticists in the US have created a robot finger, which the developers believe could be better than the human pinky.
Better in what way?
Well, in as much as a robot finger is less likely to be made numb by extreme cold. So you could have this robot finger come out and, you know, rub a surface. Even in the cold.
But what do you mean? Just to prod it, or does it actually feel the surface?
Well, the thing is, one of the things that the researchers were talking about is that human fingers do get pretty useless when it's cold. But this robot finger has this sort of skin-like surface that wraps a liquid filling, and it can identify materials by actually touching them. It can rub them. They tested it on something like 115 different surfaces, including paper and sponge and wood. When the robot finger was given a material, it would just rub it and poke it and identify it exactly as a human finger would.
So how does a robot feel?
Well, the robot feels...
I don't mean that as metaphysically as it sounds.
Yeah, it's how does a robot...
Literally, how does it feel?
Yeah, it's a bit metaphysical. But, what it does, it has various different sensors. It can detect pressure, so it knows, you know, whether it's, you know, touching an object or really pushing against it. It can also detect whether something is hot or cold and various different temperatures and things like that. So it's a really useful, potentially, little finger. Could have various applications.
For touching things in the cold or in space.
Well, this made me wonder, what else could a robot finger do?
That's a very good question.
Well, you think about it. I mean, it could obviously be used for, touching corrosive material, testing bathwater, installed in an airport.
So you could hook it up to Facebook and just poke people constantly.
That's true.
Coming soon, we'll all have these remote fingers with which to poke and touch people and things.
We'll see. But there could be other
it's
medical...
quite the vision of the future.
Yeah.
There could be other medical applications, of course, as well. It's called... The finger itself is called BioTac and was made by the University of Southern California with funding in part from DARPA, the defense agency. So, you know, the future of touching in the hands of robots, Duncan. Anyway, let's move on. Liv, the Olympics are coming up. And in addition to putting missiles on houses, the Met Police Force have been doing something else.
Yeah, well, they've been talking about using drones to for surveillance over the Olympic Park to watch out for terrorists, etc., whatever else we're meant to be scared of. And I spoke to a guy called Robert Dewar, who is the CEO of Adacor, which is a company that provides secure software for aviation companies. And so obviously he has a slight vested interest in this particular area. But what he is worried about is that because the software that he's used on drones is not regulated, he thinks there's a major security risk of them falling out of the sky and hitting people on the head.
Well, one was actually hacked last year, wasn't it?
Yes. I mean, his kind of fears aren't entirely unfounded. And in Iran, a Predator drone, which is a massive, massive plane that the US uses, was supposedly hacked by Iran, and they managed to land it softly and then kind of analyse its inner workings.
And didn't one disappear into a river in Liverpool?
Yeah, in Liverpool, police got a new £13,000, slightly smaller drone, and yes, they lost it on its inaugural mission into a river, supposedly. So drones generally don't seem to be as reliable as perhaps commercial aircraft are, because they have such strict regulation of the software. So this guy is saying that we should really think carefully before we use these drones, because even though the airspace might be clear and there might not be planes with which they can collide, they could still fall out of the sky and hit people on the head.
And there's an awful lot of research actually going involved in drones, particularly with things like non-lethal weapons, and having non-lethal weapons for things like controlling riots or controlling whatever. I mean, probably could be quite useful at the Olympics.
Yeah.
You know, where they're using even things like it's not sonar, but it's like a very loud, piercing noise that causes people to, well, obviously
wet themselves.
Yeah, stop moving. Or they could attach a robot finger.
Well, quite. Anyway, they need a better regulation of their software, supposedly.
Definitely. Well, we're going to fall out of the sky and land on the head of an ad break, but once we recover, we'll be back to talk about how halving the consumption of meat could help combat climate change.
Wired's second annual summit is coming. Following a sellout debut in 2011, Wired 2012 will feature an incredible lineup of speakers and thought-provoking talks over 2 days in London. The first names have already been announced, so find out more at wiredevent.co.uk.
Duncan, got a question for you. How much of your diet would you say is meaty, meat-based.
Meat-based.
Yes.
Surprisingly small amount. It's dramatically decreased over the last few months, actually. I'd say maybe 10% at most.
Really?
Yeah, as little as that.
Have you decreased it consciously?
Sort of, yeah.
Liv, when you're not eating porridge for breakfast, how much of your diet is meaty?
I'm probably around 10%. I do like meat, but it's just expensive, and I like to buy nice meat that I think has been treated quite well.
Yeah. Mine's probably about 50 or 60%, which means
Do you think you could cut that in half?
Well, this is the thing. I need to actually cut it in half as part of my new regime, and I could be helping the world.
Yes, that's right. Well, most listeners will know that eating meat is kind of bad for the planet already. Producing a kilo of chicken, for example, consumes nearly 4,000 litres of water. Producing a kilo of beef consumes nearly 15,500 litres of water, which is a vast, vast amount of water. By contrast, producing a kilo of lettuce consumes 130 litres of water. But it's not just water that is the problem. The other problem is land that meat production takes up. And a study from the University of Exeter reckons that if the Western world halves its meat consumption, not eliminates it altogether, just cuts it in half, then we could convert a lot of the land that's being used to feed animals and house animals into growing biofuels instead, helping to fight climate change.
Okay. And I mean, how much change are we talking being needed here?
Well, the upshot, taking into account global population increases up to about 2050, they reckon will be a cut in carbon dioxide levels of about 25 parts per million. And that's a significant amount, enough to keep global temperature rise below the 2 degree mark, which experts, climatologists believe is the point where climate change becomes really, really significant. It's not really a linear scale of what happens.
All right. Well,
go on.
Let's put this into perspective. If we don't cut down the meat that we're eating, what's the upshot there?
Well, they basically looked into lots of scenarios about what could happen. And if we continue on our current high meat, low meat production efficiency course, which is where we are at the moment, then the upshot would be an increase in CO2 in the atmosphere by 2050 of an additional 55 parts per million, which would take us significantly above that 2 degree level.
But it's all it's hand in hand with other things that are helping climate change, right? I mean, this is just one thing that's aiding
it. Yeah. I mean, obviously, agriculture is a certain part of our global emissions, and we're trying to deal with lots of those things. But the interesting thing for me is that I don't think actually halving the amount of meat that we eat would actually be too difficult for most people. That's an achievable thing to do.
Let me throw a spanner in the old works here. I eat a significantly huge amount of cows, right? And by doing that, I am keeping the amount of cows left on the planet producing methane gas a little lower. And methane gas causes damage to the environment.
That makes no sense, because if you weren't eating them, they wouldn't be grown in the first place. There'd be fewer cows being produced.
I believe that my eating of cows is also helping keep carbon emissions low.
Yeah, well, that cow that you eat had to fart at some point. And so you kind of just part of the system.
If global meat demand goes down, then the number of cows being grown, being produced, will also go down, and so they won't be farting in the first place.
Well, we've talked in the past, actually, about how there are certain people in the world trying to produce artificial burgers in a lab. We talked about this a few months ago on the podcast.
That is also true.
As an alternative, and they produce significantly less methane and could certainly help maybe divide the gap between the people who aren't cutting down meat, but...
And we've also kind of talked about people eating insects as well, using insects as a source of protein instead of traditional meat.
Yeah.
I don't know if you count insects as meat, but...
I'm not sure that one's gonna wash so well.
I think we're the biggest drain on the planet's resources. We should just start eating each other, Duncan.
Yeah, possibly.
Quite frankly.
But yeah, Tom Powell, the PhD student who led the project, he said, our global agriculture system is so inefficient right now that we harvest about a quarter of everything that grows on the land, but only about 7 to 8% of what we harvest ends up as food. So a ridiculously low efficiency rate. There are huge losses there. He's saying by focusing on making agriculture more efficient and encouraging people to reduce the amount of meat they eat by half, we could keep global temperatures within that 2 degree threshold.
Well, will you halve the amount of meat that you intake to help the environment? Drop us an email, podcast@wired.co.uk, or say something on our Facebook wall, facebook.com/wiredUK. Speaking of technology, Microsoft has launched a pair of tablets, and it makes me wonder...
Were we speaking of technology? We thought we were talking about meat.
I was talking about Facebook.
Oh, all right, fair enough.
Thanks. Yes, Microsoft, anyway, has launched two tablets called the Surface. They are Microsoft's answer to the iPad. They have 10-inch screens. They're going to run Windows 8. They should hopefully be out by the autumn. And Duncan and Liv, are these going to get you away from the iPads?
No.
No?
No, but what I'm amazed is how they kept it so quiet. They just suddenly just announced having not so much of a sniff of a mention of a tablet.
Very, very, very quiet.
I think it's just because nobody was looking.
Yeah, well, that's quite
well,
possible.
They are pretty nice looking tablets, quite bigger than the iPad. There are two versions. There's a lighter version called that runs on Windows RT. That's the version of Windows 8 specifically designed to run on ARM-based processors like you find in smartphones and other tablets like the iPad. It's 9.3 millimeters thick, has two cameras. It's got full-size USB ports, which is quite important, I think, as a differentiator, because it means you can plug in your video camera, your even your iPad, I suppose, and you know, pull media that you're creating on those devices onto this tablet. Has up to 64 gig of storage. And then there's a second model that runs a full-on version of Windows 8, and it runs on Intel's Core i7 processors, like you find in a laptop. They're the new Ivy Bridge models.
So you're telling me that there's going to be two different sets of application development frameworks for these two different devices?
Yes, but that's...
And an entirely different range of apps that will run on either?
Yes, but that's sort of the whole point of Windows 8, is that you do have this choice. It's kind of... It's a tablet OS that wants to be a desktop OS, and a desktop that wants to run fine on a tablet.
So if I'm a developer and I want to make something that runs on both these tablets, I have to design my app twice?
Possibly. I'm not entirely clear on
that. That seems mad.
Specifics.
Because Microsoft has already got problems with sort of getting people to develop apps for their mobile platforms, and this just seems to amplify that enormously.
But, you know, think of it a different way. There are a lot of people already familiar with the general framework and workings of Windows.
That is true.
And they certainly have the developer community for Windows in order to incentivize building things for a tablet. But the second one is basically going to be a full-on desktop computer with 128 gig of storage up to, and it has these Ivy Bridge processors just like the new MacBook Pros and other laptops out there. So it really is a PC in a tablet's body. Mm. But it's also going to be a lot thicker. It's going to be 13 millimeters thick. By comparison, the iPad is 9.2 millimeters thick, I think. And it also includes a stylus, but specifically a stylus for drawing and for handwriting and things like that. So it's got lots of... it's very sensitive, apparently, but we've not had a chance to...
Can you use a robot finger instead if you want?
Oh, that would be great.
Or a meat stylus.
Yes, or a meat stylus. So I'm actually going over to Amsterdam next week to have a look at some of these. So hopefully on next week's show, we should have a report back whether I've been able to use a meat stylus with it or not.
Are you excited?
I am, actually. I really am, because the iPad, you know, I do love the iPad, but I'm also keen for, you know, some better competition. The Android competition hasn't been up to snuff. People like HP came out with a touchpad, and although the hardware was decent enough, it just wasn't attractive enough for developers to start building for it. And so that died. And so you really need a competitor like Microsoft to come into the market and do something differently. And they've done fairly well with Windows Phone, and I do like what they've been achieving with Windows Phone. And I think as well this will have good ramifications for sort of for the Xbox side of things. We talked on a show last week or the week before last about the smart glass thing they're doing, which kind of enables you to interact with games and allow games to interact with your tablets. Mm. So this could be really, really interesting, but it'll all be down to the price, and we don't know how much that will be yet.
I will make a prediction.
Go on.
I will predict that this will be more of a Zune than a Xbox.
Well, this is the thing. The Zune was a really good piece of hardware.
Yes, it was. And everybody who bought one, and I'm one of the people who bought one, I loved my Zune. It was a fantastic device, but nobody bought them.
No. And it was a shame because, as you say, it was a great piece of device. A lot of what happened on the Xbox and the Zune, I think, has really fueled how Microsoft's looking at Windows and Windows Phone. So I think there's potential here. But yeah, I do sort of worry that it's going to be a little too late and a bit too much like we want to keep the Windows feel on a tablet, which is...
Yes, absolutely.
And it's going to be really expensive as well.
They say it's going to be competitive with other tablets on the market, but really they have to undercut Apple here. Mm. They have to undercut Apple. They have to bring this out at sort of, you know, £350 for the base unit in order to gain a foothold here. Mm. The other thing that's quite weird, though, is that, I mean, Microsoft has a lot of partners, you know, people like Samsung and all these people making Windows phones and making tablets that run Windows and things like that. I would feel a bit hard done to if I was investing in my Windows tablet division business, and then for Microsoft to say, yeah, we're going to come out and do our own flagship model, and, you know.
Well, that hasn't put off Google and Android. I mean, Google makes its own Nexus phones, and that hasn't put off the rest
ecosystem.
Of the Android community.
The more tablets you have with the same using the same platform, the better, really.
Mm. Well, let us know what you think. As always, podcast@wired.co.uk. Very keen to hear whether you're interested in this and whether you're going to buy one. I will have a report next week from my touching of it. Anyway, from Amsterdam to Geneva, Duncan, Higgs boson, there are some rumours that scientists have made a little discovery.
Well, possibly. Ever since hints of the Higgs turned up last December at the Large Hadron Collider, the scientists there have been refining the data that they've gathered, the vast amounts of data, to try and work out whether they're allowed to call it a discovery or not. Mathematician Peter Voigt has said, the bottom line is now clear. There is something there which looks like a Higgs is supposed to look.
But this happened not too long ago, where there was some kind of discrepancy that people thought this could be Higgs, and it effectively turned out to be something like a measurement failing, or, you know, someone pulled the power lead out of the back of the laptop.
Wasn't that the neutrinos?
Oh, I do beg your pardon. It was the neutrinos. Well remembered.
Yeah.
Sorry about that. Well, anyway.
But we did have a discussion of them almost discovering it on this podcast.
Yeah. Yes, that would
that
have
was
been
December.
Yes, that was in December where they announced some results that they found some stuff. And yeah, as I say, they've been analysing the work since. And yeah, physics bloggers are kind of speculating that the scientists from the Large Hadron Collider will announce that they have discovered the Higgs boson at the next International Conference on High Energy Physics, which will take place at the start of July.
This is exciting stuff. I mean, for anyone who isn't familiar with the Higgs boson, I mean, this basically explains how particles have mass. So this would be one of the biggest discoveries in physics of the last 100 years.
It's even more than that, I'd say. It's the final piece of the Standard Model, the one bit that we haven't found, the last piece of the jigsaw, which the Standard Model, by the way, is a framework that's developed that kind of describes how all particles and subatomic particles and forces all interact. And the Higgs boson is critical because interacting with the Higgs field is, as you say, what gives all the other particles their mass. If we don't find it, basically we know that we don't understand the universe in a way that we thought we might have done.
And so the criteria for discovery is a little bit tricky. It's not as clear-cut as we've definitely found it.
No, exactly. What we have to do is we have to wait and see a 5-sigma signal. And what that means is that there is a 0.00028% probability of it just getting those results by chance, which is a tiny, tiny amount. Right now, the Higgs rumours say that there are 2 4-sigma signals that have turned up at both of the separate Large Hadron Collider experiments. And combining those 2 4-sigma results should be enough, people think, to clear that 5-sigma hurdle. So,
what, 4 plus 4 divided by 2 does not equal 5?
That's not quite how the maths works in this situation.
Very low odds, though. I mean, Liv, if that was a horse, would you bet on it?
No.
But
I mean, what it is, it's about multiplying 2 probabilities together, which are both very, very low already. And and if those kind of get down to that 0.00028% chance, then we get to call it a discovery. And
right.
We've solved science.
But we haven't solved science because we still have the problem that... You know, the Standard Model does not work well with quantum mechanics.
Yes,
I mean, the grand unified theory of physics, which is something Einstein died not being able to solve. You know, there's still two things. So we have the Standard Model, and we have physics that governs things like gravity and planets and mass and stuff like that. But then down on the sort of subatomic level, quantum mechanics, we've got all these other interactions and infinities and all this stuff going on. Mm. And those two models do not work together. You know, standard physics breaks down when you get to a singularity or something in a black hole. This got a bit deep, but so that would still be the next hurdle. So if you're thinking this is going to be the end of science and you can hang up your lab coat and go out and be a, you know, model, then keep that lab coat on, friends.
Work on the other models instead.
There's more to do. Well, that's going to do it for the news this week. But in another bit of sort of news, it is Alan Turing's centenary. We do not need to introduce who Alan Turing is. But Liv, you have been pioneering a fantastic package of content on the website this week that, well, why don't you explain it? We've got so much stuff about Alan Turing.
I have been pioneering, indeed. I like that. It feels like I've been kind of climbing up a mountain of content.
You are very own Higgs boson.
No, we've just been looking at various different achievements of Alan Turing, you know, from some of his most obvious achievements, such as cracking the Enigma during World War II, through to kind of developing early computers. But we've got some fantastic guest posts, including one, for example, from Max Newman, who was Turing's mentor. Max Newman's son has contributed quite heavily to one of our guest posts. And he has some fantastic memories of a childhood where Turing used to come on holiday with him and his family, and how he used to beat Turing at Monopoly, and how one night he found Turing kind of coming to their door in their cottage, and he was trying to write an invitation to dinner, and he wrote it in by scratching it onto a rhododendron leaf because he didn't have any paper. And just some wonderful little anecdotes like that. And then we've also looked at some other scientists throughout history who've been persecuted. Obviously, Alan Turing was arrested for homosexual acts, and there was a lot of controversy recently where people were trying to get him pardoned retroactively, but he wasn't pardoned. And so we've looked at other scientists such as Galileo, who got arrested for promoting the view that the Earth went round the sun rather than the opposite.
The heliocentric view.
The heliocentric view, exactly.
Yeah, he had house arrest until he died, I think, didn't he?
Exactly. And then there was Rhazes, who was a medic in the Arab world, who brought Greek teaching to the Arab world, and the clerics didn't like it. So they beat him to death. Oh, no, beat him over the head with his own manuscript until he went blind.
Wow.
And so he couldn't practice anymore.
They were so much more imaginative with their punishment back in the ancient world.
They really were. And then you went to Microsoft Research and you interviewed their first ever employee.
Wasn't it? This was kind of a bit of a bonus, actually, because I went over to Microsoft a few weeks ago to look at some stuff that Microsoft Research is doing. In fact, and I had a report from that a few weeks ago. But I did speak to Rick Rashid, who was employee number one of Microsoft Research. He's been there for about 20 years. And I got him to speak to me a little bit about sort of Alan Turing and the Turing test and sort of recent advances in computer science in that field. And I thought I'd just play just a minute or so of something that he was telling me about how significant the Turing test is these days. And I'll let the clip speak for itself.
Well, I think the definition of the Turing test in some sense is getting a little bit complicated as time goes on. We can actually build systems today that actually do a pretty good job of fooling people under some circumstances. And so, you know, the sort of the simplest version of the Turing test is probably not the most interesting. I mean, what was really trying to be captured by Turing, I think, with this notion of the Turing test is this notion that says, you know, can we build a computing system that does some specific function that human beings do as well as a human being does, or at least in a way that's indistinguishable from a human being? And in many areas now, we're able to do that, whether it's things like chess playing, certain kinds of question answering tasks, certain kinds of analysis tasks. And so we're making our progress toward that. That doesn't mean that we're making intelligent machines, but it does mean that we're able to do things that traditionally we thought only humans could do. We certainly have examples where people have fooled people with computers for significant periods of time. Now, you can always ask the question, well, if you ask enough questions, you can probably figure it out. And I think that's true. But I think in you know, modest periods of time, we can fool someone into thinking that a computer is really a person. But we're still a long way from anything that might resemble what I would call true artificial intelligence, because we really don't even understand how humans think well enough to be able to do that.
Rick Rashid there from Microsoft Research. So Liv, I mean, great collection of features we've got here.
Yes, if you can go to the website and search for Turing Week, you'll find all of the articles. There's one more thing that's worth flagging up, is that we have our very own Turing-inspired cipher on the website, which has been created for us by the Cybersecurity Challenge people. And you can go online and you can see this picture and you can try and decrypt what it says in this image. There's a message and there's a prize up for grabs as well.
Mm. So if you go to y.co.uk/Turing, you will find all of our content about Alan Turing, all of these great stories, and maybe win some stuff too. And I think on that note, we're going to wrap things up. Duncan, why don't you tell people how they can get in touch with us with their wonderful feedback that we admire and respect so much?
Probably the easiest way is to email us, podcast@wired.co.uk. We check that mailbox all the time. We also check our Twitter all the time. We are @WiredUK, and we're on Facebook too, facebook.com/, you guessed it, WiredUK.
And you can give us a call, as always, on our Skype little automated Skype mailbox, 0208 123 0468 from a landline mobile. That's a UK local rate. Leave us a message, 30 seconds or longer. Got any messages about Alan Turing? What does Alan Turing mean to you? Let us know. We'll play them on the show. And I think on that note, we will see you next week.
Goodbye.
Bye.
And happy birthday, Alan. Check, check, 1, 2, Nate Langston Lips here speaking to you.